You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 2nd. I'm Caitlin Wood from Drake University, and here is our first story. The Daily Nonpareil, where your story lives. In-school wellness conference. Jackets learn from community partners. The picture by Scott Stewart. Charles Clark delivers a keynote address to sophomores and seniors during Jackets Thrive at Thomas Jefferson High School on Friday, October 27, 2023. Keynote breakout conferences replace class for Jackets Thrive by Scott Stewart from the Nonpareil. Brandon Bowen had never attended a professional conference. Sure, he's only a senior in high school, but it's an experience that can make all the difference when entering the professional world after graduation or college. And it's an experience Bowen gained on Friday morning. Students can get out of the classroom and learn different skills, said Bowen, who was a member of the Thomas Jefferson High School Student Council. It was a cool experience for everyone to be able to organize something this big. Thomas Jefferson held a special one-day wellness conference Friday for its students called Jacket Thrive, replacing the first six classes of the school day. Members of the student council helped plan the event and designed a t-shirt for the occasion. As they arrived at school, students stopped by a registration table to pick up lanyards with a schedule including a keynote presentation and various breakout sessions. Community and school district speakers discussed a variety of topics, all centered around wellness. Vicki Morello, superintendent of the Council Bluffs Community School District and Jacket Thrive, was designed to help students work on having a healthy mind, body, and soul. We really wanted to provide our students with some opportunities to have about healthy eating and even yoga, and even just things of interest that would be good for their mindset, Morello said. 25 community partners helped provide sessions, and the district brought in a guest speaker, Charles Clark, whose talks stressed the importance of learning from failure, becoming a better person, living with intention, and finding your big why in life. Mental health, and specifically how to tackle anxiety, was a common theme among several of the sessions, along with leadership, physical health, and personal safety. "We about talk mental health a lot," Bowen said. "A lot of students don't realize how much stress they're actually going through most of the time, because they put it off and they say, that's just what a regular student does. And they don't realize that because of all of their hard work and everything, they need that support, which we're giving through these events. And that's very important for every student to have." Morello said that the wellness and mental health were stressed coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic. And she said that the Jacket Thrive event was taking the district's approach to those subjects to the next level, hoping to pioneer an annual event that could be brought to Abraham Lincoln High School down the road, and perhaps at middle schools too. "A lot of students will bring up the word anxiety, so we want to have some conversation around what is anxiety," Morello said. "Our guest speaker, Charles, has really talked about that, and in his first session, he talked about how you can get anxious about even riding a roller coaster ride. So we're excited to be able to bring that to life and allow our students to dig in." Clark is a three-time track and field national champion and became the sixth fastest man in the world at age 22, overcoming a tear in his right quad muscle that debilitated his athletic career. He's now a globe-trotting motivational speaker and author. His keynote discussion of the roller coaster related how he overcame a personal fear that he didn't even realize he had at the time when visiting Universal Studios in Orlando. "So we're in line, and my body is starting to shake," Clark said. "So I said, okay, I'm going to try, I'm going to relax, and I'm going to enjoy this ride." He seeks reassurance from the operator that the roller coaster is safe, getting the thumbs up in return. "There is no thumbs up about this situation," Clark said. "I'm scared right now." "The ride takes off," he continued. "I'm not making any of this up. Ride takes off, and all you hear is this little girl yelling so loud. Everybody's turned around. The little girl's disrupting the entire roller coaster experience. And everybody's turning around and looking at me because I was the one that was yelling like a little girl." He tried again. The same thing happened. "I didn't know that there was this big screen with your face on it as you exit off the roller coaster ride," he said. "This dude looked like he was having a full-blown heart attack." And so he tried again. Something different took place this time, Clark said. The thing that I was afraid about, I started to love it. And I wanted to remind you guys, sometimes in life it's going to be that way. Sometimes we're going to have these really big fears that draw out certain things in us that we don't want to experience. Moving along to Rural School Officer Requests Prompts Questions by David Golbitz. When Sheriff Andy Brown assigned one of his deputies to be a rural school resource officer, he didn't imagine receiving blowback. But when Brown approached the Pottawatomie County Board of Supervisors to request permission for a second officer serving the 5 rural school districts, the request was surprised by the elected officials. The first indication that the October 24th board wasn't going as intended was when Supervisor Tim Wickman asked Brown if the county had what's called a 28E agreement with the school districts. We had a 5-page, policy 28E agreement with the schools currently, Brown said. Wichman replied that he hadn't seen such an agreement and that the other supervisors indicated that they hadn't either. Iowa Code 28E provides the ability for governmental entities to enter into contracts with one another. For example, the city of Council Bluffs has a 28E agreement with the Council Bluffs Community School District to provide one resource officer to each of the district's high schools, middle schools, and the Alternative Learning Center. The Council Bluffs interlocal agreement further states that the school district reimburses the city for the salaries of each officer assigned to one of its schools. The 28E should have been signed by the board, Wichman told Brown at the supervisors' meeting. Did anybody on that board sign that? In a word, no. Funding was another issue that caused consternation among the supervisors. To fill the first SRO position, Brown said that he took a position that had been reserved to transport people between the courthouse and the jail and moved it to the rural school districts. Ever since COVID, the court system is not the same as it used to be, Brown explained. We're not transporting nearly the prisoners that we used to have to do because a lot of it is done on video at the court, which is a great safe way to do things. So there was a position in the courthouse that didn't need to be refilled. Because we're not transporting 30 inmates a day for court. So we use that position that we already proposed for this and just put it in the schools. The problem with Brown reassigning the position from the courthouse to the school districts is that the officer's salary is being paid by county taxpayers, which includes residents of Council Bluffs, Carter Lake, and Crescent. So we're providing an officer in the rural schools and Council Bluffs and Lewis Central schools are paying for it too. Wichman said, if you're using general fund dollars that's coming from the people in Carter Lake, Council Bluffs, McClellan, it's coming from all the towns. Wichman referred to Council Bluffs' 28E agreement with the Council Bluffs School District, in which the district pays for 100% of Council Bluffs officers. Carter Lake and Crescent residents would contribute to those officers through their school taxes too, in addition to paying for the rural sheriff's deputy. So if the schools want SROs, I want to be able to help them get what they want to. But we have to be fair to taxpayers, Wichman said. If we're providing a resource officer for the rural schools, we can't levy Council Bluffs for it. The board determined that Brown would have to get together with County Attorney Matt Wilbur to go over the agreement he signed with the rural school districts and then bring it back before the board, which happened Tuesday. At that board meeting, Brown, accompanied by Chief Deputy Jeff Thulin, returned to the boardroom. Wilbur was also present. Wilbur verified that the agreement Brown signed with the rural school districts is not the required 28E agreement, though he said that it does have most of the language he would want to see in a 28E. It's actually pretty well written, Wilbur said. Everything I would have asked to be in it is in it. I wouldn't mind there being a tighter indemnity clause that makes it very clear that it's the sheriff's Sheriff's Office employee supervised by the Sheriff's Office. It is not a school employee. It is not supervised by the school. With regard to the current County School Resource Officer, Kurt Ferguson, Wilbur said that he spoke with the Iowa State Auditor's Office to make sure it's okay to fund this position out of the general fund, you know, from a legal perspective. They say as long as it's a public purpose, and certainly law enforcement protecting schools, is that they did not see a concern with that, Wilbur said. To pay for the new SRO that Brown wants to approach, the school districts have already applied for and have been awarded a federal grant from the U.S. Department of Justice through its Community-Oriented Policy Services Program. Each of the five school districts, AHSTW, Riverside, Tri-Center, Trainer, and Underwood, will receive $20,000 grants, which they will then pass on to the county. That $100,000 total only covers the school year, however, so the sheriff's office will have to come up with about an extra $14,000 to cover the summer months when school is out and the officer would resume normal duties. Then Thulin thinks that there will be no problem for the coming year. I can't tell you it's actually that amount of money, but it's very close, Thulin said. Ultimately, the Pottawatomie County Sheriff's Office plans to hire two new deputies to fill current vacancies, which they are already in the budget. After those deputies are trained and ready to patrol on their own, they will not be on the road by themselves until probably next July 1st, Thulin said. More seasoned deputy will be assigned to the second SRO position for the county's rural school districts, with most of their salary being paid by the $100,000 in federal grant funding. Brown will come back before the county board for its approval of the 28E agreement once it has been finalized and signed by the school districts. Half of Pottawatomie County residents vaccinated. Tim Rower from the Nonpareil. More than half of Pottawatomie County residents are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. The latest information from the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services shows about 54.1% of residents are up to date with their COVID-19 vaccines. That's higher than some southwest Iowa counties, but about average statewide. Pottawatomie County's residents who are still in need of COVID-19 vaccines are encouraged to make arrangements through their doctors or pharmacies that currently offer such vaccines, according to the local public health department. To find a local business or medical clinic offering COVID-19 influenza vaccine, go to vaccine.gov. The federal government recently ended the distribution of free COVID-19 vaccines to the state and local agencies, leading to a transition to the commercialization of the vaccine, said Maria Sieg, the county's public health administrator. However, federal grants providing funds for COVID-19 vaccines for eligible children and adults who have no insurance or are underinsured has continued, Sieg said. She recommends these individuals contact her office for more information. Meanwhile, her office continues to offer vaccines for the flu and general public. Approximately 800 doses of flu vaccine were ordered, Sieg said. We have plenty more on hand and could order more, she said. Shots are available to the public and cost no more than $20 for those who have no insurance. Otherwise, people should check with their insurance company to determine if they cover these vaccines, Sieg said. We do take walk-ins, she said. The public health office is located at 600 South 4th Street. It offers after-hours vaccination clinics on the fourth Tuesday of each month from 4 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. Then the picture, Maria Sieg, public health administrator at the Pottawatomie County Public Health Department, talks about the importance of getting flu vaccines and other preventative health measures while sitting outside her office on September 10, 2020. Taken by Joe Shear of the Nonpareil. Meet Botna Bend Bison's herd Saturday. Scott Stewart, the Nonpareil. Families are invited to meet the bison herd at Botna Bend Park to celebrate National Bison Day on Saturday. The third annual Bison Fest will take over the park at 42926 Mahogany Road in Hancock, which is about a 45-minute drive from Council Bluffs. The event runs from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. and will run rain or shine. Attendees can learn more about bison and the efforts to protect them. Other activities include atlatl throwing, hayrack rides, bison artifacts and fossils, crafts, and bison's wool spinning demonstrations, food, live music, and presentations about the role bison play in the prairie ecosystem and Native American history. Partners include the Union Pacific Railroad Museum, Nature Conservancy, and the Coralville Lake Devonian Fossil Gorge. Bison Fest is about remembering and celebrating an American icon that was once wiped out to the brink of extinction by the early settlers, from an estimated 30 to 60 million to less than 1,000, according to a news release. Today, their numbers hover around 222,000 thanks to conservation and education efforts across the country. The event is free, but an entry fee of $3 per vehicle or annual park membership is required to enter the Potawatomi Conservation Park. The festival is sponsored by Golden Hills Resource Conservation and Development. Visitors are asked to bring cash for bison chili, chicken noodle soup, homemade fries, and funnel cakes, available on a free will donation basis from the Feed Trough, an Oakland-based business. Find more information about Bison Fest at potconservation.com/calendar. Picture: bison meander about their enclosure at Botna Bend Park in Hancock on March 7, 2017. Officials with the Potawatomi County Conservation Commission, the precursor to the Potawatomi County Conservation Board, brought bison and elk to Botna Bend in 1968, 3 years after the park's opening. Villisca Murder House sold for ghost tours. Scott Stewart, the nonpareil. A trip to Villisca could be the cure for anyone still pining for spooky season's recent departure. U.S. Ghost Adventures recently signed a contract to buy the infamous historic Villisca Axe Murder House, and 2024 dates are available for ghost tours and overnight stays. The company said that the site of the unsolved 1912 murders is the third historic haunted location added to its portfolio. It also operates the Lizzie Borden House in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Brick House Inn in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, as well as ghost tours in cities across the country, including Denver and Chicago. The Villisca Axe murders remain an unsettling enigma in American history. In this quaint Iowa town, 8 unsuspecting victims, including 6 children, were bludgeoned to death as they slept. Despite a nationwide manhunt, multiple suspects and trials and murders remain unsolved, the company said in a news release. The Villisca House was restored in the 1990s by Martha and Gavin Lynn. It was transformed into a living museum, allowing visitors to experience it the way it was the night out of the crime, without electricity or running water. I'm looking forward to serving as a steward of America's history and the legacy of Lynn's have built, said Lance Zoll, president and founder of U.S. Ghost Adventures. We will serve the public that wants to learn about the story of these victims who never got the justice they deserved while supporting the ghost hunter community. The Josiah B. Moore House has since been listed on the National Registry of Historic Places. The house seems to haunt itself as its own entity, said Johnny Hauser, who has served as general manager of the Villisca Axe Murder House for 20 years. From my own experiences to what guests have shared, it takes personal approach to its mental manipulation and mirrors to back to guests and the inner workings of their own personal lives. The house has chronicled hundreds of reports of footsteps, children's voices, and moving objects. Ghost hunters have documented a range of phenomena and evidence of unexplained activity, such as electronic voices, according to U.S. Ghost Adventures. It's unsettling what it has revealed to the people, and if the victims are haunting the house, there is something much darker over it, Hauser said. Picture: Darwin Lynn, shown in 2008, purchased the Villisca Axe Murder House in 1994 and spent more than a decade restoring it to its original structure. Red Cross builds back blood supply before holidays. The American Red Cross is urging blood donors to make and keep appointments now to help hospitals restock blood production for patients ahead for the holiday season. Donors of all blood types are needed, especially type O blood donors, and giving those platelets to help recover from a significant shortfall in donations throughout late summer and early fall. Patients are counting on life-saving care now and all season long. Those ready to help can schedule an appointment by using the Red Cross Blood Donor app, visiting redcross.blood.org, or calling 1-800-RED-CROSS, 1-800-733-2767. As a thank you, as well as to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the film Elf and create holiday cheer, all who come to give November 10th through November 30th will receive an exclusive pair of Elf Plus Red Cross socks while supplies last. Visit redcrossblood.org/elf for details. To get blood, donors must present a blood donor card, driver's license, or two other forms of acceptable identification. They must be 17, 16 with parental consent. Teens must meet height and weight requirements, weigh at least 110 pounds, and be in generally good health. Upcoming blood drives in the region include November 2nd, 8:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m., Tri-Center High School, 33980 310th, St. Neola. November 3rd, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., Care Initiatives, 1403 Harrison Road, Dunlop. November 3rd, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., Madison Hy-Vee, 1745 Madison Avenue, Council Bluffs. November 6th, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., New Horizon Presbyterian Church, 30 Valley View Drive, Council Bluffs. November 6th, noon to 6 p.m., Trinity Lutheran Church, 512 2nd Street, Glenwood. November 9th, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., Council Bluffs Public Library, 400 Willow Ave, Council Bluffs. November 13th, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., New Horizon Presbyterian Church, 30 Valley Drive, Council Bluffs. November 14th, noon to 6 p.m., Logan Magnolia High School, 1200 North 2nd Ave, Logan. November 14th, 8:30 a.m. to 2 p.m., Riverside High School, 18997 Highway 55, Oakland. November 16th, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., East Mills High School, 1505 East 15th Street, Malvern. November 16th, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., All Care Health Center, 902 South 6th Street, Council Bluffs. November 17th, 11:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., CHI Health Mercy Hospital, 800 Mercy Drive, Council Bluffs. Find more at redcrossblood.org/give.html/find-drive. Moving along, meet the candidates, Lewis Central School Board. The nonpareil received the following responses to a questionnaire which have been edited for length and clarity, but they have not been independently vetted. For complete responses at tinyurl.com/cbelection2023. Amy Adkins, age, declined to respond. Occupation, property manager for Adkins Properties. Why are you running for office? I'm running for a seat on the Lewis Central School Board because I believe in our kids and support our staff and administration. I want to continue to be an advocate for all and make sure that they have the tools they need to be successful. What change do you want to see? I'm very excited about the bond issue that is on the ballot November 7th. We are bursting at the seams and have some serious physical plant needs coming up. If the bond passes, we will be able to address many of those needs at all of our buildings and provide additional services to our students. Over the next 4 to 5 years, we will build a new elementary, update our existing middle school, and several other projects that will be of value to students and staff alike. What experience do you bring? I've served on the board since 2005, having to step down from 2012 to 2015 due to a brief change in my residence. I have been part of multiple communities throughout my time on the board, as well as attending meetings at the state and national levels. I enjoy learning how to serve the district to the best of my ability and will never turn down a learning opportunity. How do you describe your politics? The best way to describe my politics is that I will make a decision based on facts and what I believe is best for the district. I've never voted to go further from my own personal agenda, nor have I even had an agenda to push. Rash decisions are not something that I support and will always ask for more information if I'm uncomfortable with what has been provided. Why should voters select you? I am a Titan through and through. I come from a family with strong ties to the district. My daughter graduated in 2020 and was the 17th member of my family to walk across the stage to receive her diploma. From 1955 until today, there have only been 4 years, 2003 to 2007, where a member of the Adkins family was not enrolled in the district. Tradition is important to me, but that does not just mean by my family name. I believe that being a Titan makes you part of something bigger than just your immediate family. Your Titan family is committed to making sure that all students have the ability to be part of something special. Jeremy L. Bach, age 40. Occupation, supervisor, training and quality with Metropolitan Utilities District. Why are you running for office? Having four boys who have or are attending Lewis Central, their education and the education experience of all students are important to me. 23 years ago, I cannot wait to finish school and put it behind me, but now I just find myself wanting to be more involved so that I have the best understanding of decisions being made that impact our future generations. What change do you want to see? 1. Increase awareness for students that need additional attention as well as those that excel. The bond will be important to achieve this, allowing for smaller class sizes, giving teachers more time to spend with students individually. 2. Better college preparation for high school students. Based on recent state testing, Lewis Central only scored 14% for college readiness. I believe we have an opportunity to reach students earlier than their final 2 years of high school. 3. Improve upon non-underserved student proficiency and decrease the gap between proficiency scores of non-underserved students and underserved students. Currently, non-underserved students scored 78% compared to underserved students who scored at 58% proficiency. What experience do you bring? I have served on three Lewis Central committees in the past 2 years. These committees ranged from reviewing survey data to providing insight on the school's budget. Having my certification in Lean Six Sigma and analytical background provides me the ability to look outside the box and think of different and more efficient ways to approach a situation. How do you describe your politics? My politics are straightforward. Make decisions based on sound information, research, and multiple facets of opinions. This allows for a person to look at the decisions from many different angles. Why should voters select you? I believe that every child should have the opportunity to be successful in their education journey. Every child learns in different ways, and being able to channel and find an approach that helps achieve his or her own potential will be second to none. I will always make decisions that benefit the teacher/student relationship because having a strong bond with your educator can make for a strong education. Travis Houston, age 46, occupation, poker room supervisor. Why are you running for office? I am running for school board to ensure that every child who attends LC is given the opportunity to receive the highest level of education. What change do you want to see? We are living in a growing district and the community bond issue is of vital importance. If passed, I want to help keep Lewis Central a destination district for many years to come. What experience do you bring? Since running in 2019, I have been appointed twice by the board to fill a vacancy. I'm an LC alum and have lived in the district for over 30 years. I've made frequent visits to all buildings in the district and have made strong relationships with both administrators and educators. How do you describe your politics? I consider myself a pragmatist who is 100% for public education. Why should voters select you? I will continue to support LC staff, parents, and students. I am committed to being one of the most approachable and visible board members I can be. I will continue to tour the schools on a routine basis with administrators, cheer on the Titans, whether it be in the classroom, on the athletic field, or on stage. I will always do my best to be present when called upon and make the best decisions for the district. As I love to say, it's always a great day to be a Titan. Alex Sorensen, age 29, occupation, software engineer. Why are you running for office? I'm running for the Lewis Central School Board because I view it as an opportunity to give back to the community and be actively involved in something I am passionate about. I'm committed to ensuring that the school system quality is not only maintained, but continually improved. I firmly believe in the value of public education and want to play a role in bringing positive changes that benefit students today and my own children and their peers in the future. What change do you want to see? I believe that the Lewis Central Community School District is headed in the right direction, and I would like to see a continued focus on maintaining and improving the positive trajectory. My goal will ensure that the district continues to provide quality education and supports the needs of our students and educators. What experience do you bring? I hold an undergraduate degree in secondary math education, which provided me with insights into the educational system through classroom experience. Additionally, my diverse professional background spanning from startups to corporate America has equipped me with a broad perspective on problem solving and decision making. I believe these experiences will enable me to contribute effectively to the school board's mission. How do you describe your politics? My approach to politics is driven by a dedication to enhancing the Lewis Central Community School District. I will strive to make decisions that prioritize the educational needs and well-being of our students, teachers, and community. Why should voters select you? My degree in education, professional experiences, and current phase of life with young children will allow me to bring a unique set of perspectives to the board. I am committed to listening, learning, and ultimately making decisions with the best interests of the students, teachers, and community in mind. Timothy Wright. Age 45. Occupation. Quality Assurance Management. Why are you running for office? I have two children in the Lewis Central Schools, a daughter in high school and a son in junior high, so I'm a stakeholder in their educational experience. I don't just care about their experience, but I care about the experience for all our kids. What change do you want to see? So much change I'd like to see, but rather continuous improvement. Some obvious areas need to be improved have been highlighted with the checklist of items that this requested school bond is intended to address, but I would like to see the school district and school board improve their means of being able to self-assess these needs. I know some in the community were shocked by both the list of infrastructure needs the district has and the cost to fix things, but unless you're asking the right questions, you don't know what you don't know. An organizational plan that addresses self-assessment typically helps prevent situations like this and provides more transparency. What experience do you bring? I have served at the director level for quality assurance for a number of years, so I have strong skills in leading process and project management. I have a professional certification from ASQ as a certified manager of quality/organizational excellence, so I can lead continuous improvement projects within any organization. I serve on the board of directors for Family Incorporated, which is a local group providing early education and early child wellness checks in our community. Also volunteer for the Alzheimer's Association as a member of the Longest Day Group. How do you describe your politics? The Lewis Central School Board of Directors is a nonpartisan position, but I am registered Republican and I am fiscally conservative. Why should voters select you? I can make the arguments that out of all the candidates up for vote, that I am the strongest advocate for the Lewis Central Community Schools, and I would support that statement with my leadership role in the community group supporting the school bond. Yes for Success, which hopes to fix the previously mentioned infrastructure items and responsibly provide the potential support for the school district to accommodate the additional families that will feed into our school system. You will also see me supporting youth and high school sporting events. You're listening to the Council of Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 2nd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Caitlin Wood from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. And now, we'll return to today's obituaries. Jean L. Robinson. March 20th, 1928 to October 31st, 2023. Jean L. Robinson, age 95, of Council Bluffs, passed away on October 31st, 2023 at her home, surrounded by her loving family. Jean was born March 20th, 1928 in Milbetta, Nebraska, to the late Clyde and Ruth Lee Adamson. She graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School in 1946. Jean married Richard A. Butch Robinson on December 19, 1947. They were blessed with four children. In addition to her parents, Jean was preceded in death by her husband, Butch, in 2020, sister Anne Wyatt, and brother Dennis Adamson. Jean is survived by her children, Rick Alice Robinson, Cindy Kurt Falkenhayner, Deborah John Scanlon, Sandy Rocky Starr, 10 grandchildren, 14 great-grandchildren, nieces, and nephews. Funeral service Friday, 11 a.m. at Culler O'Neill Meyer Woodring, Bayless Park Chapel. Interment Walnut Hill Cemetery, visitation with the family 1 hour prior to the service on Friday at the funeral home. Memorials are suggested to the Alzheimer's Association or St. Jude Children's Hospital. Moving along to sports. Titans fall in 5-set classic in state semis. Lewis Central's Ashlyn Haverman makes a pass as Anna Stromer watches during Class 4A state semifinal against Indianola Wednesday at Extreme Arena in Coralville. Titan teammate Anna Stromeyer backs her up. Picture from Jim Nelson Photos. Courier Sports Editor. Article by Austin Heinen. Coralville, Iowa. Number 6 Lewis Central season came to a close after a 5-set showdown with number 2 Indianola in the Class 4A state tournament in Coralville's Extreme Arena. 32, 23, 25, 25, 28, 18, 25, 18, 21, 25, 15, 10. That was a great match, Titans coach Mike Bond said. We've played in some big matches all year, and it's one of three times where we weren't able to come out on top. These girls left it all out on the floor. We played with no regrets. We hit our potential for the season, as our motto was for the season, we maxed out. Sometimes it's just a couple of things that makes a difference, and that's how close it was here. Titans scored the first 6 points in first eight, but the Indians answered with six straight points and then four of the next six to pull ahead late with an 18-15 lead. But the Titans would score seven of the next 10 points to go in front and hang on for a 25-23 win in set one. The Indians came out hot in set two, leaping out to an early 8-3 lead. The Titans would climb back within one later in the setback and could never overtake their opponent as the Indians ended the match at 1-1. Another picture, Lewis Central, Anna Strohmeyer, strikes an attack during Class 4A state semifinal against Indianola Wednesday at Extreme Arena in Coralville. St. Albert falls to Boyden Hole in four sets in 1A state quarterfinals. Peter Burnett, Coralville, Iowa. St. Albert started strong but lost the next three sets in a four-set loss to Boyden Hole in the Class 1A state quarterfinals at Extreme Arena Tuesday night. The Saints, 23-15, fought to win a close back-and-forth first set, 25-23 over the Comets, 22-11. A Caitlin Hendricks kill finished the set on a 3-0 St. Albert run. A 6-1 run to start the second set established a comfortable hold for the Comets, which would hold over the next two sets. Saints fought to trim the deficit to 9-7, but 5-0 Boyden Hole run put the number 2 seed back in control. Boyden Hole cruised the rest of the way for a 25-16 win in set 2, carrying the momentum into the third set. But St. Albert battled to a lead, 13-12, and the set seesawed until a 4-0 separated the Comets, who won the set at 25-19. The fourth set was also tight early, but another 4-0 run gave Boyden Hole a 14-8 lead. St. Albert cut the deficit down to 2, but the 5 straight Boyden Hole kills pushed the Comets to a 23-16 lead. The Saints didn't go down easy, however, scoring 4 of the next 5 points and fighting off 3 match points, ultimately a kill by Lily Mora ended the Saints' season. Hendricks and Georgie Bonnet led the Saints with 11 kills each, while Kylie Wiesack, Molly Wise, Naomi Sherrill added 5 each. Lily Cron and Ella Clushman combined for 32 of the Saints' 36 assists. Ellie Monahan set a 1A state tournament single game record with 40 digs, while Klusman added 15 and Grace Christensen 12. Hendricks had 3 total blocks, 1 solo of the team's 4. 6 seniors, Lily Crone, Ella Klusman, Georgie Bonnet, Kylie Wiesack, Hendricks, and Missy Evazik see their careers at St. Albert come to a close after returning the Saints to state for the first time since their freshman year in 2020. Number 21 Kansas battles Iowa State as Big 12 race heats up. Field Level Media. There's a logjam at the top of the Big 12 standings with 5 teams tied for first and 2 others just a game behind. 6 of those 7 teams will have head-to-head battles this weekend, including number 21 Kansas traveling to Ames, Iowa to face Iowa State on Saturday evening. The Jayhawks 6-2-3-2 Big 12 jump back into the rankings after knocking off previously unbeaten Oklahoma on Saturday, their first win over the Sooners since 1997. Iowa State, 5-3-4-1, returns home after a convincing win over Baylor in Waco, Texas. The Cyclones have fully recovered from a sluggish 1-2 non-conference portion of the schedule. They have won 3 straight games, including a 30-18 defeat of the Bears. Iowa State's Cartavius Norton ran for 2 touchdowns against Baylor, while quarterback Rocco Becht threw for 238 yards and a score with 1 interception. The Jayhawks are coming off the high of registering their first home win over a top 10 team since 1984. Kansas scored the first 14 points before giving up the next 21, the first of 6 lead changes. Quarterback Jason Beam put the Jayhawks back in front with a 38-yard touchdown run late in the third quarter. The teams traded touchdowns and failed two-point conversations until Dylan Gabriel's one-yard run put the Sooners back up 33-32 with 5 minutes and 22 seconds left. Beam threw his second straight interception with a 2-minute 29-second left, but the Jayhawks forced a 3-and-out. On the 4th and 6th, Beam found Lawrence Arnold for a key conversion for 37 yards. Devin Neal punched it in from the 9-yard line, and Kansas deflected a desperation pass by Gabriel in the end zone on the game's final play. Beam was filling in for Jalen Daniels, who has missed 4 games due to a back ailment. When Jalen Daniels is healthy, Jalen is the starting quarterback, but we're not at that point today, Kansas coach Lane Leipold said early in the week. We're not at that point yet to decide that. He works out every day, and some days are better than others. Regarding Bean, Leipold added, he's a pretty quiet guy. He's respected. His confidence as a leader has grown with his confidence in the offense and his personal play. The Cyclones are wary of both Bean and Daniels. No matter who it is, it's elite speed at quarterback, Iowa State coach Matt Campbell said. They've got 2 elite quarterbacks and 2 guys that have the ability to really challenge you in the running game at the quarterback position. We played some mobile quarterbacks already this year, and you've got to hang your hat on of that and do your best to simulate that in practice. In terms of his offense, Campbell expressed pride in the work of his linemen. That group in general that's probably been the most impressive piece that's accelerated faster than anything is the ability to protect the quarterback, Campbell said. Everybody has to be really good when you're talking about protecting the quarterback, including the quarterback himself. Kansas owns a 51-45-6 record all-time against the Cyclones. The Jayhawks snapped a 7-game losing streak with a 14-11 victory in Lawrence, Kansas last year. Iowa HC Ferentz caught off guard by son's dismissal. Athletic Director Goetz made announcement on Monday. David Selvig, Quad City Times. Iowa City. One day after an announcement saying his son would not return to the coaching staff next season, Kirk Ferentz spent nearly 20 minutes talking about exactly that on Tuesday. The first 10 questions directed at the Iowa head football coach Kirk Ferentz at his weekly press conference were about his son Brian, Hawkeyes offensive coordinator, who will coach out the current season but not return in 2024. Iowa interim athletic director Beth Goetz, who ultimately made the decision to let the longtime head coach sons go, also faced a throng of reporters after Kirk Ferentz spoke, deflecting most questions to her statement released on Monday while also praising both coaches. I hope all Hawks will join me in showing appreciation for the commitment and passion Brian has brought both as a student athlete, as an alum, and as a coach in the program, Goetz said. We have an incredibly successful head coach, a Hall of Fame head coach, with a steady hand focused on leading this program for the rest of the season. Ferentz preferred such significant changes but be handled during the off season, but throughout the more than 30-minute session with reporters tried to return the focus towards Saturday's opponent, Northwestern, at Wrigley Field in Chicago. I can say my policy has typically been to evaluate everything, players, coaches, all that, postseason, because in season we've got a lot on our plates, Ferentz said. It's been that way probably since I started in 1981. There's just not enough time in the day. Everything is precious in terms of time. To me, it's a better time. It's a less emotional time. I can give you a lot of reasons why we've done it that way, but it really doesn't matter. It's not significant right now because we are dealing with something we have to deal with, and we will. Ferentz too clear of getting too deep into his thoughts despite multiple probing questions from the large contingent of media members present. He also wanted to be the sole voice on the matter, at least for now. Players were not made available to the media on Tuesday as they normally are. Obviously, we have a biological relationship. I'm very fond of him, Kirk Ferentz said to Brian, the Hawkeyes coordinator since 2017. I've had a lot of relationships with people that have worked here, and that's one of the things we do. If it was anybody on this staff that fell in this category, I'd feel bad about it. I'm guessing they would encourage us to keep moving forward, too. That's what you have to do. The move came after a third straight year where the Hawkeyes have struggled offensively. Iowa best beset by injuries to key players this season. Ranks last in the FBS in total offense at 232.2 yards per game. Last February, former athletic director Gary Barta restructured Brian Ferentz's contract, cutting his salary $50,000 to to 850,000, requiring the Hawkeyes to average 25 points per game in order to secure his return in 2024. With that unlikely to happen, Getz made the decision to make the announcement Monday that Brian Ferentz would not return next season. She did not go into detail in conversation with the Ferentzes other than to it was not a decision made on donor or fan pressure. Anytime you're in a situation, you try to tune out what's around, Getz said. Our job is to evaluate the information we have and make the best decision you can at the time for the program and the university. Ferentz said he supported his son's decision to agree the rework contract in February, but there seemed to be little choice at the time. I think when all that took place, Brian is the one who signed it, and I think he thought it was the best option available, and I would have co-signed it, Kirk Ferentz said. Not that it was my business. In his 25th season as head coach of the Hawkeyes, Kirk Ferentz deflected questions about his own future or potential offensive coordinator hire. There are, as they always are, to worry about this game in bigger scale, bigger picture for these four games. That's where my focus has been this entire season, he said. Really, what I'm worried about right now are the next 4 weeks. I think anything beyond that is getting way ahead. Lewis Central downs defending champions Xavier in 4A state quarterfinal thriller. Pete Berntet. Number six, Lewis Central down defending champion number 3 Xavier in a 5-set thriller in the quarterfinal round of 4A state volleyball tournament at Extreme Arena in Coralville Monday night. We stayed steady even when we got down in the 5th set. This team stayed steady. Titans coach Mike Bond said, we trusted the plan, kept trusting in what we do and trust each other, and we knew good things would happen. We just stuck to the game plan and it worked for us. The Titans opened by jumping out to an early 11-7 lead in set one. In a back-and-forth first set, 10 ties, 5 lead changes, ended with a 6-0 LC run for a 25-21 win. Brooke Larson picked up 7 kills, 5 digs, and 5 assists in the opening set. But the Saints won the second set comfortably, serving up 5 aces and cruising to a 25-13 win. Lewis Central held off a Saints charge in the third and won a pair of blocks in the 2 of the last 3 points of a 29-19 win. Xavier continued the strong run to end set 3 by jumping ahead 9-5 in the 4th set. The Titans swung back to cut the deficit 17-16, and while they stuck around, the Saints tied the match 2-2 with a 25-22 win. The decisive 5th set was truly a back-and-forth battle of wills, a question able to touch violation replay. After LC took 3 of the first 4 photos, Xavier answered with an 8-0 run to take a 9-4 lead. The Titans, however, rallied to cut the deficit down to 13-12 when a replayed point after a 2-touch violation went the Saints' way. But the Titans held serve, fought off 2 set points, and won 17-15 on Larson's 19th kill of the match. Larson also added 18 assists, 14 digs, and 3 solo blocks. The Titans totaled 17 as a team. We knew we had some points to make up after their run, Bond said. As I told them, though, you don't need to make it up all at once. We scored a couple of quick points, had a side out, scored some more points, and had another side out, and just kept scoring in small bunches before running out of time. Haley Erickson dished out 27 assists, while Ashlyn Haverman and Anna Strohmeyer had 11 kills each, followed close behind by Maddie Roanfield with 9. Haverman served up 3 aces, and Addison Holt led the Titans with 23 digs. Libby Fandel had 28 kills for the Saints, and Molly Garrison dished out 45 assists. LC advances to Wednesday's semifinals against number 2 Indianola at 12:25 p.m. Picture, Lewis Central, Anna Strohmeyer, 12, looks on as Ashlyn Haverman scores a kill against Cedar Rapids Xavier at the Class 4A volleyball tournament on Monday in Coralville. Another picture, Madeline Ostemore of Lewis Central watches her kill get past 2 Cedar Rapids Xavier defenders on Monday in Coralville. LC, Glenwood, and Underwood look to punch tickets to the UNI Dome. Austin Heinen, Nonpareil. Who? Glenwood versus Bondurant Farrar. Rankings. Glenwood is the number 3 seed. Bondurant Farrar is the number 5 seed. Records. Both teams are 8-2. Last week, Glenwood beat Norwalk 21-0 and Bondurant Farrar beat Pella 23-6. Where? GCSD Activities Complex in Glenwood. When? 7 p.m. Friday. The word. For the second straight year, the Rams are one win away from a trip to the Cedar Falls in their first trip to the UNI Dome since 2017. Standing in their way are the Blue Jays of Bondurant Farrar, who were also in the quarterfinal last year before falling short. They are seeking their first trip to the UNI Dome since 2015. "We're fortunate and thankful to be here, but we have a really big challenge this Friday," Rams coach Corey Foss said. "Bondurant is just super deep everywhere on the field. They've been dealing with some injuries, but just go and plug the next guy into their system and are all just tough as they've been all year. The size and physicality they have is phenomenal. They have great skill players, but they're loaded all over." The Blue Jays coming off a win over Pelish after losing to them 2 weeks earlier by a score of 40-13 and avenged their previous defeat primarily through their run game, which totaled just shy of over 300 yards last week. They have two running backs, Titus Cram and Kayla Moore, who together combined for over 1,200 yards. Despite that statistic, their quarterback Jordan Ryle is more capable of moving the ball through the air with over 1,500 yards passing, and Reed Faltzgraff has been the favorite target with 9 touchdowns and just shy of 700 yards receiving. "No one has really been able to figure out a way to slow them down yet," Foss said. "We're going to do some things that we're familiar with and have done over the past few weeks to attack them and basically try to limit the plays. It's easier said than done, but we like our players and we feel like we're playing our best football, and just like them, we're going to lean on our talent and see where it takes us on Friday." The Rams are seeking just their third ever appearance to the Dome. Who? Lewis Central versus ADM. Lewis Central is the number 2 seed and ADM is the number 9 seed. Lewis Central is 8-2 and ADM is 7-3. Last week, Lewis Central beat Lamar's 42-10 and ADM beat Denison Schleswig 42-0. Where? Titans Stadium in Council Bluffs. When? 7 p.m. The Word. The Titans enter their 7th consecutive quarterfinal game against a familiar base in ADM in a rematch of Week 3 opponents, where Lewis Central finished with this upper hand 38-31. Also, time has passed and the two teams now meet with a higher stake contest. The Titans aren't putting much weight into that week as the Tiger come prowling through Council Bluffs this time. Like every week, we talk about going 1-0 each week, and this week just happens to get you to the UNI Dome if you win, Titans coach Justin Kamrad said. "It's the dream and goal of every high school kid to have this shot. Home or not, we have to come in prepared mentally and physically and maximize each possession. At this point of the year, every point matters, so on the other side of the ball as well, finishing drives in the red zone is going to be a high priority." The Tigers held Denison Schleswig to just 153 yards of offense last week defensively while rushing for 406 yards offensively, as their quarterback Aiden Flohr had a big night, scoring 4 of the 6 touchdowns and rushing for 253 of those yards. Flohr ran for 334 yards against the Titans last week, thus the Titans have emphasized playing more assignment sound on the defensive side. "The big thing for us is identifying what they do well and eliminate the big play," Kamrad said. "Last time we played, they had a lot of big plays against us that turned down into touchdowns, and we have to prevent those and correct those previous mistakes. We weren't very gap sound against them last time, and they got us with their speed. Defensively, we have to attack them in different areas and ways." Titans are looking for their 3rd consecutive trip to the UNI Dome, and 5th since 2018. Who? Underwood at OABCIG. Rankings. Underwood is number 2 in Class 1A. Underwood records. Underwood is 9-1 and OABCIG is 8-2. Last week, Underwood beat AHSTW 42-0. OABCIG beat Trainer 35-14. Where? OABCIG football field in Ida Grove. When? 7 p.m. Friday. The Word. For the 4th straight year, Underwood is in the quarterfinal game. Meet them this time is another program more familiar with this level of play as well. The OABCIG Falcons, who are looking for their 3rd trip to the UNI Dome since 2019, after finally getting the bye the quarterfinal last year with a win over Pella Christian. These athletes in Underwood are no strangers to big stages in the playoffs and believe that will help them execute their plan this Friday. The great thing is we have guys that have not only seen this game but played it and won this game. And I do think that's very important, Eagle coach Nate Mikkelsen said. OABCIG is a program that, going back to 2019, has 3 dome appearances and 2 state titles. They've had a ton of success. That said, I know our kids will be prepared and will be confident in this moment like they were before. A lot of these kids are just 3 or so months removed from playing in a state championship for baseball. We have a good group of kids that have played in some high-level situations and competition, and hopefully those experiences can help them focus and power through in this one. The Falcons sport a pass-heavy offense with Bryson Kollar. Kollar has thrown over 2,300 yards and 25 touchdowns. As impressive as that all is, 18 interceptions and a slight blemish to that, which has been one of the Falcons' weaknesses. Nonetheless, the Eagles expect a high-scoring game as both of these offenses have flat-out score and at pretty much any point of the field. They like to throw the ball a lot, McCallison said. As many times as he's thrown the ball, I know he's got some turnovers, but if you throw it as much as he does, that's bound to happen every once in a while. As great as a passer, he can run it, and did so really well last week. Between him and their running back, their offense was really clicking. We know we're not going to stop them completely, but if we can limit them and force some second and third long situations, we can be successful. Offensively, we're just going to try and be balanced as much as possible. Being successful on the ground and air is important. We'll just take what their defense gives us and really dictate what we want to do and move the ball consistently. Underwood is looking for its third ever trip to the UNI Dome. The Eagles have outscored their opponents 336 over the past six games. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 2nd. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. I'm Caitlin Wood from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.